Okay, so I'm going to start by reading to you from a journal. Now, I've kept very few journals in my life, but when I went to a retreat centre called Gukiloka, for a 16-week retreat, in the course of which I was ordained, I decided to keep a journal. I've got two of these books. And to be honest with you, I hardly look at them. I rarely look at them. They sit on my shelf. I rarely look at them. I rarely read them. But I don't think anybody else has ever heard anything from them. But in writing this talk, or thinking about this talk, I decided to open it and just have a look. And this was a paragraph, literally the paragraph that I alighted upon. Well, I'm going to read you part of it now and part of it later. Yeah? So this is... Now, that's clever, isn't it? Where's my bookmark? Okay, so the meditation this morning was a community metta bhavana. Yeah. With Artapriya announcing, who was leading the retreat, announcing the names of the other retreatants. In brackets, I smiled when it came to me. There was an image of Manju Ghosha, yeah, who's a figure... a bodhisattva figure, a Buddhist archetypal figure over on the wall there. There was an image, that this is what appeared in my imagination, of Manju Ghosha in a pale blue sky. Yeah, so it just popped up in my mind. With his left hand, he held out a pink satin pillow. Yeah, held out a pink satin pillow. On which were two pills. One red, one blue. Yeah? I don't know if people have seen The Matrix, but this is exactly what happened in my meditation. It was just like The Matrix. Okay. And I think this is the same as in The Matrix. The blue one led to samsara. Yeah? Attachment, imprisonment in sense experience, ordinary sense experience, ignorance and so on. The red one, to release, to liberation. The urge to take the blue pill was very strong. Yeah. And I could kind of feel it in the meditation as coming out of the right-hand side of my body. So all the kind of right-hand side, I could just kind of... Anyway, so feel this urge to take the blue pill. Indeed, I couldn't help myself. I reached out and I picked it up. I put it in my mouth. Okay. So, I wonder how many talks have a period during the middle where the person writing it gets a bit intoxicated with ideas about the subject of the talk. So much so that at some point they remember that they are giving a talk. So I had a period this afternoon. Well, I'll carry on. I started writing this talk in a rather strange way. I seemed to be writing something that was a bit more of a performance piece than a talk, more theatre than a clear, cogent presentation of ideas. Even practically minded ones that recapitulate a teaching of the Buddha's or present them in a more sort of modern form. Now, I will resist reading what I wrote as these ideas were banging around my mind, because it does have a danger of being a bit self-indulgent. But what I was experiencing, there was something of value there. There was something important about what was happening, as this sort of these ideas were sort of reverberating around my psyche, and I was getting excited by what was happening. In a way, there was a certain rawness to what was going on, as if something had been stripped back, and even a certain lack of coherence that is quite valuable. I wonder, even in those moments, where there wasn't even a bit of danger, a kind of spiritual danger. Now, I don't know what will become of what I sort of wrote down, but I wanted to offer a certain gesture to you. And don't worry, I will return to Manju Ghosha and his pills at some point. So, I wanted to tell you a story. I wanted to tell a bit of a story, well, a bit of something of my story, something of my spiritual practice. I've been practicing now for 14 years, which is over a third of my life. And anyway, I wanted to say something about what's happened, in a way. Obviously, that's very difficult in the course of just a few minutes, really, but I did want to say something about it. And the spirit of it was that I wanted to say something more than I would usually reveal. I wanted to say something a little bit more than most of you, or at least some of you, will know or will have heard. Perhaps even than any of you have heard. And I think there are dangers in this. One of the things, I have quite a few responsibilities here at the Buddhist Center. And these responsibilities do involve me being up front in sort of public and, talking in front of people and so on, both in the Buddhist Center and outside, speaking in public. And I think that one of the things that can come up in that, one of the dangers, is a sort of a slightly sticky, if sometimes subtle, attachment to the sound of one's own voice. Yeah, I'm afraid so. Yeah? I'm afraid so. And I don't think I'm alone in that being a danger. Yeah? But it is a danger. And it is a danger. The second thing I thought was a bit of a danger was that in talking in public, it can lead to, again, a subtle but an inflated sense of one's own perspective in the kind of relative scheme of things. A slightly inflated sense that you've got something to say, as it were, in a certain way. I suppose I wanted to, quite literally, quite genuinely ask for a bit of patience from you, and even forgiveness in the extent to which that does arise and oppress my mind, because it does come up, these forces. I wanted to acknowledge them because I just wanted to clear the air. In a way, part of me talking about revealing something and talking about my own spiritual life and practice is a bit of a confessional aspect of it, and I just think there are things I wanted to be aware of as I was talking, because I wanted to open up a bit more, a bit of sincerity, a bit more. I did want to be open to you, with you. And there's a certain reason why this has taken on a bit of a greater weight, because things have changed a bit since a week ago. In a strange way, what I wanted to do was to meet you, because because I realised that part of me had forgotten you. Yeah? I'd forgotten you. The image that comes into my mind is if I've been, as if I've spilled a bit of dinner on my jumper, and it's got a bit crusty. And I don't know if you ever had those moments where you're kind of doing your business, walking around, and you look down and you realise it's crusty, and then all of a sudden what flashes into your mind is all the people you've met since you last ate, and therefore might have seen this big crusty mark on your jumper. And all of a sudden you kind of go, oh my God, I've got this big crusty mark on my jumper, I'm going to scratch it off. And it's kind of like, I mean, obviously, I'm kind of joking there, but almost there's that sense in which I've just got a bit stuck trying to scratch something off, and I've completely forgotten that you're there. Yeah, who it is that actually I'm interacting with, who it is that I'm relating to. Yeah. So, in a way, I just wanted to stand and be in front of you, and to speak about my life. And in a sense, for the words, not to just speak words about my life, but for the words to be my life. Yeah? And for you to be my life. Yeah. And, I've got to look at you, in a way, to look at you, and to be here, me looking at you. You here looking at me. Me looking. Just this. And I was recently on a retreat, and the reason why this has taken on a little bit more weight or got a bit strange is the retreat, something happened. We changed our name. We had a ritual in which we changed the name from the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. This is kind of the sort of official change from the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order to the True Ratna Buddhist Community. And I was walking away from the puja in which it happened, and I just thought, I'm different. We're different. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm actually different. And since then, things have been happening. Strange, interesting things have been happening. And it's a bit like what I wanted to talk about tonight, what I planned this week, was to talk about some kind of signs and things, you know, markers of my own spiritual practice and progress. But it's a little bit like what's been happening over the last few days, is that I've been in the middle of one of these signs, and I sort of haven't a clue what's happening with it yet. But it's not that just that I'm in the middle of this sign, you're in it as well. And you're actually in it now. And it's just bizarre, it's weird. And I don't know where I am, I don't know where you are, but it's fantastic. Anyway, I'm going through a very interesting process, and maybe I won't say any more than that. Just that it's a bit like what's been happening is that I keep meeting lots of paradoxes in my mind, and the paradoxes just then keep collapsing, and then other things keep rising up and collapsing, and it just seems to be these very, very strong forces. I can't tell whether something, I'm sort of being squeezed into something, and like I'm being born or something in a certain way, or whether something's kind of exploding up. Fascinating process. And someone gave a talk on the retreat, and they told a story of the Emperor's New Clothes. And the thing about the Emperor's New Clothes, what I find really, there's a really funny story about me knowing about him, because for a long time people would talk about this story and I would almost think I would have to know what it was. But the whole story is this thing where you can't kind of admit the truth because everyone will realise how stupid you are. And I never wanted to admit that I didn't know about the emperor's new clothes because I didn't want to seem stupid. So I had this thing. That's been the theme through a bit of my life. When it pops up, I thought, the emperor's new clothes. Now, I know that story, but I just couldn't remember. So I didn't want to admit that I couldn't remember. And it's really, you know, so there's a real irony with reading that story. Anyway, she told this story. And, you know, everybody knows that the king was naked. Yeah, everybody knows the king was naked. But what is really, he was naked, but he couldn't be seen. The king couldn't be seen. People couldn't see the king being naked. You just couldn't do it. But it's like, it's just, it's a prison not being able to see. And I suppose I kind of, part of me revealing this is I wanted that sense of nakedness, and I want us to be prepared to see. Tonight, maybe just for tonight, just for a short amount of time, just to see. Yeah. I know you're pleased I didn't wear my underwear, but just my underwear. So, and I was hoping in a way that you, in the process, you might find that helpful. You might find that helpful. There might be something of value for you in what I was going to say. Whew. Okay, so. So there's kind of, my story and what's happened through the 14 years of my spiritual practice. And there are many traditional ways to express the Buddhist path. And I think something of my 14 years have been sort of working out how my experience fits or relates to these traditional explanations of the Buddhist path. And I've wondered, you know, so is it tempting to kind of see things too prematurely in Buddhist terms and somehow not develop my own kind of markers, my own signs? Or, you know, do I just sort of push out the traditional bits and kind of have this thing about my experience, the preciousness of my experience? And I think there's a certain kind of creative tension in that, or can be. But the important thing about it is that they're about signs, about recognizing signs or markers, you know, whether they're presented traditionally or whether they emerge from within oneself, just sort of recognizing these signs within ourselves. And the importance of signs, I was alerted to, in particular, more recently by an ordinary member called Bodhi Ketu, who gave a talk about in February on a weekend I went to, on ecstasy and bliss in meditation. And usually you give a talk title like that, and everyone goes, that sounds interesting, ecstasy and bliss, I have a bit of that. And I think I took a few things from it. It was a very beautifully given talk, actually, I have to say. Very sort of tenderly spoken, very sensitively, calmly spoken talk that I really appreciated. And a couple of things I took out of it. Well, one of the things he said was that part of developing the dhyanas, getting more absorbed in meditation, becoming more concentrated, was about him recognizing or realizing what happened when he did get more concentrated. I know that sounds a bit odd, but it's a bit like him realizing the process, the signs of what happens when he starts to become more absorbed. So it's almost like developing a particular understanding or in relation to his own experience of what happens. Yeah, particular recognition of what actually happens. So understanding what happens when it gets concentrated, and recognizing it, giving that some attention, those signs, some attention. So starting to learn what happens when it gets concentrated and starting to give that kind of more attention
when it popped up in meditation. Maybe it was an image, maybe it was a few words, maybe it was a sort of felt sense. Just giving that bit more attention. It was as if a voice in him, and this is me, it was as if a voice in him was saying, keep seeing. Yeah. Keep seeing. And the second way in which I was alerted was the person who ordained me, called Vasantra, who gave me my name, Padma Kumara. I gave a talk a few years ago, before this was in 2002, it was before I was ordained. And it was, the talk was called Here Be Dragons. Here Be Dragons, subtitled Disasters, Dilemmas and Dead Ends on the Spiritual Quest. Yeah, on the Spiritual Quest. Very interesting talk. And in it, he begins by looking at talking about how we map the spiritual life, as he puts it, how we map the spiritual life. And he talks about how it's mapped in the by the Buddha, you know, by the tradition. We've got spiritual friendship, ethics, and so on, meditation, choosing a quiet spot and entering into absorption, and then reflection, contemplation, and then sort of insight, awakening, understanding. And he also talked about how the Buddha's disciples map, you know, how it's spoken about, that they kind of mapped their own spiritual practice. And as you know, a lot of the Buddhist scriptures, or some of you know, a lot of the Buddhist scriptures are made up of encounters that the Buddha had with various people. And I'll just read to you one here. The Buddha has an encounter with someone, a wanderer called Vajragata. And Vajragata, after their encounter, says, Magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama, who's the Buddha, has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha. From today, let Master Gotama remember me as a follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. Okay, so you get that, and in the tradition, you get these kind of disciples, and it can become a bit sort of formulaic as you read it, but. Yeah, that's a whole... obviously one could unpack that. There's a lot in that. So Vasantra was wondering about, are there different ways to map this spiritual life? And particularly the ones which aren't so straightforward. Yeah, the kind of... the dilemmas, the disasters, the dead ends. And the dragons. Our encounters with dragons. And he came up with four different ways of sort of talking about it. I'll just mention these briefly to you. The first one was a crisis of belief. The second one was falling into the heart center. The third was finding oneself at odds with others' views or ideas, particularly or perhaps even one's teachers and friends. Finding oneself perhaps having different ideas or views than one's teachers or friends. And then the last one he said is called the end game looms. And he talks about the crises that can happen as we get older. Yeah. He's talking to a bunch of order members who are now, like him, in their 50s or 60s and so on. I mean, there's obviously younger ones there as well, but the end game looms. Yeah. So, this is kind of moving me into my own kind of signs or maps. And as I say, I'm experiencing myself as kind of as in the middle of one at the moment. And I'm not quite sure what's going to emerge. I'm not quite sure how you're going to emerge from it. Yeah. I mean, that might sound a bit weird, but I'm really not quite sure how you and I and you are going to emerge from this. The first thing I've written down here is fear. That's the first word. What do I want to say about fear and my kind of experience of that in the kind of journey? In a way, it's fear that brought me to spiritual practice. Yeah. Or that... some of you have heard me mention or even joke a little about that, you know, I used to take drugs a few years ago, and particularly recreational drugs. And I used to sort of joke about this, but there's a whole kind of series of events that happened from kind of doing that. You know, I basically just took far too much over too short a period, and, you know, my kind of brain, body, being kind of melted a little bit, and I experienced quite a bit of fear, and it became particularly problematic because all my friends were in that world, were in that sphere, and I found it very difficult to kind of have the confidence to kind of break out of that and chart a different course at that time. So I suppose, you know, that reached a certain point where I had to do something about it. Now, there's much more I could say about that, and I want to bring out a few kind of signs or things that have happened along the way, perhaps images. So the first is I've got about my experience and subsequently with fear on the path and how I've tried to work it or work with it or what's happened. And the first one is dreams. So very often fear would appear to me in dreams in the form of snakes or sharks. So very often I'd find myself in a dream, and I'd be in Wigan International Swimming Pool. Yeah, I grew up in Wigan, and it's got an international swimming pool, and it's proud that it's a Wigan International Swimming Pool. You know, it's quite a big pool. And I swam a lot. I swam from a very early age. I don't think my mum could swim, so my parents took me swimming from when I was about four, and so I became quite a proficient swimmer. And I've got lots of kind of happy memories, spending time with my dad when I was doing my swim. Anyway, so very often I find myself in this pool, the big pool, and there's only me, and there's a shark in the pool. And it's kind of chasing me around this pool. And obviously, yeah, I experience a lot of fear and tension. And I'm never kind of quite sure where it is. And various scenarios play themselves out. It was almost like, you know, the shark would always be beyond my reach. It would always be dangerous to me. That never changed. Yeah. So different things would happen, or I'd forget, or I'd wake up, you know. But the shark would always recur as this symbol of kind of fear. Anyway, when I was on this retreat, actually, I had a dream. I was on the edge of a kind of dance floor in like a pub. You know, pubs have small dance floors sometimes. And I was on the edge of a dance floor, but it was during the day. And there were two big dogs. They're sometimes small, but they're very stocky dogs. They usually have small legs and Staffordshire Terriers, is that right? Anyway, there were two of those, and they were gingery blonde colour. And in the dream, one of them was just ultra close. I could feel its burning kind of tension in the dream. I could just feel this very, very strong energy, and I had to get past them. And I was so kind of close. And And it was right up against me, and I could sort of feel their aggression. I was, as I say, I was burnt by it. But then I kind of woke up and I kind of forgot about the dream. But then a few days later, something happened, something shifted, and I wasn't sure what it was. But the dogs started to appear again, particularly in meditation. And they would appear when I would have some kind of unskillful thought or fear and so on. But the dogs no longer seemed to symbolize fear anymore. What was happening is that when things would come up, the dogs were protectors of me and my heart, so they were no longer dangerous to me. And what they would do is that they would run after what it was that was in my experience that was trying to cause me upset or struggle. And it was this, and I just kind of, after a while I learned I could just send them out to go and kind of chase or round up what it was that was kind of could potentially take over my mind. It's a very, very interesting process of just something subtly shifting or transforming. And in that case, I know what happened, I know what it was. It didn't relate specifically to the dogs, but there was just a sort of, I was just sitting on my bed one day, in very ordinary circumstances, and just something shifted, something opened, and the dogs appeared in a form very differently. And the reason why I might relate that to the sharks is that I've never dreamt about sharks in the same way ever again. I do find that quite interesting. Quite interesting. So another thing is about, I've got down here, is not having a clue. Now I think sometimes our intelligences, my intelligence, me, intelligence, can fool me into thinking I've got an idea about things. I've got an idea about what things work and so on and things like that. And actually underneath it can be quite a bit of emotional confusion. Yeah. Actually, I don't really have an idea about things. It's just an idea. I don't really know what's going to be happening. And there's confusion. And there's a sense of shifting sands a little bit. Is the expression. And this reached a bit of a crescendo to me at the time that I was going to be ordained. Yeah? So I was going to get this kind of thing, in case I was going to join a Buddhist spiritual community. And I remember thinking before I was ordained, just in a couple of days leading up to it, I think it was, that I was just thinking, my goodness, I've got absolutely nothing in my life and experience before to give me a sense of what being ordained into a Buddhist spiritual community is about. I've got absolutely no clues. Yeah, I just don't know what's going to happen at all. And after the initial shock of realizing this, because it was a bit like, oh my goodness, you know, it was like I just scanned my life, and there was just nothing there to give me a hook, to give me a clue about what was going to happen, in a way. I know that sounds a bit strange, but yeah, it's something I experienced. And it was funny, what started to happen is a source of strength started to emerge. The only way that source of strength expressed itself was in a sort of phrase or a word or a kind of sense of knowing that I was just going to do it anyway. Yeah. So I kind of recognised that I just didn't have a clue, but I was going to carry on anyway. Yeah. In a way, it didn't matter. I didn't need to work it out. I didn't need to try and figure it out. I didn't need to get that sense of sort of certainty. I was just going to carry on proceeding anyway. Yeah. And there's something in here about emotions and about the whole way in which I relate and we can relate to emotions, as it were. And the sense of kind of fear of being overwhelmed by them or kind of oppressed by them or taken over by them or something like that. And there's something about sort of beginning to learn to relate to emotion as just another experience or something. It's just another experience, like any other. And I suppose the question that would come to me is just looking at all the time with this, or beginning to, what's the dharmic perspective? So that's another little sign that I noticed coming up, that I try to give some attention to. When that question comes up, what's the dharmic perspective? Because very often, in the question, I just need to give the question more attention, more of my awareness, and that's enough. Yeah. What's the dharmic perspective? The reason why I have the demon dagger here is that, and I can't mention very much about this, but one of the things about this, that when I learnt about this symbol and the idea that actually I didn't have to destroy the demons, I just needed to pin them down so I could see them. It was a bit of a revelation in a way to me, that the demon dagger isn't there to destroy the demons. That's not the point. The point is to see them, and that's what the demon dagger helps you to do. And I just find that very helpful. And since then, the demon dagger has become a very beautiful symbol for me. Sometimes I don't think about it very often for weeks, months at a time, but it's somehow in my psyche. It's in my life. It's in my history. I didn't have to kill the fear and the anger. And I think those two are quite related. I just need to see it. The other bit I've got down here is, or kind of sub, as a slightly sort of integration and independence, and I've spoken a bit about emotions to some degree. Another theme in my spiritual life and practices is about thinking for myself, I suppose just what that means, really. I mean, there's an interesting humorous story I won't relate now, where I've related it before to some people, I'm sure, where it's from Blackadder, and Blackadder's trying to teach Baldric how to count, and he's choosing beans, and there's this very amusing, well, I always find it a very amusing scenario where he says, you know, now I've got two beans. Then I add two more beans. What do I get? And Baldric says something like, some beans. And Black is like, oh, no. Baldric, no. I take these two beans, I add two more beans. What do I get? A small casserole. And, you know, and it carries on. And Blackadder's getting increasingly frustrated. And he says, look, Baldric, the eight beings of the Indus have mastered this, or something like this. In walks Percy with this enormous ruff. Yeah. Blackadder says, Percy says, you know, what do you think of my new ruff? And, you know, and Blackadder says, I think you look like a bird who swallowed a plate. Yeah? I think you look like a bird who swallowed a plate. And he says, actually, it's the latest fashion, I'll have you know. And he says to, and Black, so Blackadder says to Baldric, what do you think of Percy? And he says, I think he looks like a bird who swallowed a plate, my lord. And Blackadder says, something which is also very beautiful, he says, Baldric, that's what I think, Baldric. That's what I think. What do you think? Thinking is so important, Baldric. What do you think? And Baldric says, there's this pause, this beautiful pause, and Baldric says, with total sincerity, he says, I think thinking is so important, my lord. And I've reflected on this a little bit, as just this kind of, what does that mean to think for oneself? You know, what does that kind of mean to have a sense of one's own thoughts, to arrive at your own conclusion about something? Yeah. And I suppose, I was at a day when we celebrate, one of the things the International Retreat has replaced is the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order Day. So it was a day that used to be held in the UK every year to sort of celebrate the movement, and I was in London for one of these, and what happened? I don't know. I was just in conversation with someone, or I just was thinking about something, and I just realised that the conclusion I'd reached about something was completely my conclusion. It was completely my own conclusion. It was not in any way affected by what anybody else might think about that. any idea that I had to have a thought that either fitted in with an idea I had about life or an idea that someone else had about life. It was a conclusion that wasn't concerned to try and meet with ideas in society or anything. I just realised it was totally sort of independent of those sort of emotional kind of stuff. And it was beautiful. It was fantastic. Yeah, it was fantastic. And, you know, I've had others, obviously, and I continue to have others. No, I've just had one. That would be a nightmare, you know. That was it. Oh, blimey, they were all, you know. And so, just sort of thinking for oneself. And you know, that sign is something that, again, like Bodhi Kata was saying in his talk, is just to, when that pops up, I know now to give it some attention. It's like I don't just let it waft away and something else to come in. It's like there's a sort of an intuition or an instinct in me which just gives that attention. Okay, I'll just mention one or two other things about my meditation practice, and then I'll refer to the Buddha, and then I'll tell you, finish the quote that I was started off at the beginning of the talk here about Manjikosha, what happened when I took the pill. And so meditation, one thing I noticed, one sign I get is that I get this sense, this is when I'm starting to get more absorbed, where it's as if, I don't know, like I'm about to enter into an unknown dark place. And it's like there's a bunch of me. There isn't just me, there's a bunch of me there. And it's like I say to everyone there, okay guys, I'm going in, or something like that. And it's quite comical in a way, it's very light. But I kind of get it repeatedly coming up. You know, I get to meditate, I just notice, I'm saying, and I get this sense, right guys, I'm going in. And it's like, it's just a bit like, I'm just garnering energy, more energy, for the to take into the meditation. And it usually happens at the initial beginning stage of that process. But again, I give that attention, I let that happen, and let that sort of few words just affect my experience. Yeah. I just see those words when they happen. Another one that I can get is a tickling, a kind of tickling in the brain. Yeah. And it happens right in the centre of my brain, so right in the centre. And I just know now to give, it's quite subtle, and it's a bit like, first of all, when it started to happen, I'd just drift off to that kind of numbness in my foot, yeah, and which would then, you know, I'd start thinking about Coronation Street or something like that. And then it would happen again, and then I'd noticed that I just need to give this some attention when it happens. And when I give it some attention, it just really allows my meditation practice to kind of open up and fill out. It allows me to go deeper in the practice. I get much more kind of absorbed. It's a sign. It's a sign of that it's very helpful for me to see. So yeah, those are a few kind of signs. You know, working with emotions, kind of thoughts or ideas, and in meditation. And we will all have our own signs. And the thing is to kind of recognize them when they come up for us. And what I wanted to do now is, in a way, was just bring us back to the Buddha. Because, you know, we have these sort of, sometimes these formulaic expressions within in the texts. The Buddha had his own signs. I mean, there's the often reported sign of a rose apple tree. You know, the Buddha, that was a sign for the Buddha. He just remembered that when he was younger, he sat down and he got very absorbed in meditation. And it's a bit like he probably had that memory before. But he saw it. He gave it some attention. And he took on board what giving it attention would mean for him. What it would open up. And for the Buddha, what it opened up was that he needn't be afraid of the pleasurable feeling that arises from skillful action. It's a wholesome, it's a wholesome action that's preceded it. He needn't be afraid of that pleasure. You know, he's been through his whole period of denial of the body and denial of pleasure and so on. But he needn't fear that. And it was a real clue for his awakening. Yeah. It was a real sign. Another one is one that's not quite, maybe you are very familiar with it, but I don't often hear it reported, is that the night he had, at this time, he also had a dream. And he had four different images in the dream. The first image, his body is as vast as continents, and he lies down over this kind of world in a certain way, this globe, with his kind of, he says he's got his feet in this ocean over here, and his kind of body's leaning across this continent over here, and so on. And I just take this as I interpret this as a sign. He saw it as a sign of what was, it's talked about in the text as a sign he was going to wake up. I mean, I take it as a sign as an expanded consciousness. You know, a sense that his mind, his being was expanding, you know, beyond the, you know, the limits of the body, beyond it. And it was a bit like the dream, you know, or the way it's written. It's like he gave it some attention. Yeah? He saw it. He saw the implications of taking that on board. So the Buddha had these kind of signs, and you know, he learnt to relate to them as well. So yeah, we'll have our own signs, and you know, I really encourage you to give them attention. In a way, kind of your freedom will lie in that. You know, my freedom will lie in giving those signs more, and the signs that will continue to emerge, more attention. So for the Buddha, it led to a kind of faith, a confidence, a trust in what he was doing. And with my own practice and experience, when these things happen, that's what emerges, is a deeper sense of faith, and confidence, and trust in myself as a Buddhist practitioner, in the path and the fruits of the path. Yep. So, I'll finish now by just concluding my excerpt from the Metta Bhavana. So I'm in meditation, and I've had this image come up of Manjugosha and his pink satin pillow, and the two pills, the blue and the red. And as I said, the urge to take the blue pill was very strong, and I could feel it coming out the right side, hand side of my body. Indeed, I couldn't help myself. I reached out and I picked it up. Holding it between thumb and forefinger, it occurred to me that I could try it. I could taste it. I could put it in my mouth. So I did. And it tasted very unpleasant. It tasted very unpleasant. I can't remember what the taste was, but what I get in my mouth is sometimes I kind of, actually what it reminds me of is sometimes when I was taking drugs, and the kind of powder would congeal at the back of my throat or in my mouth, and it was a bit quite sickly feeling, kind of sort of unpleasant, and I'd have a sense of foreboding about something. And that's what it reminds me of. That's what's coming to mind, actually. But I can't directly remember. Then I moved to the red pill. Yes, unfortunately, my image, it wasn't one or the other. Then I moved to the red pill. After tasting it, I was hanging from a kind of metal platform very high in the air. Very high in the air. I'd completely forgotten all about this, by the way, just to let you know. I was hanging from a kind of ring or rung, right on the underside edge of this platform, that was hanging in the air. And what I wrote was, I let go and I kind of fell, but also didn't. And I didn't hit anything. It was completely open.